This is Barbara Lang, production designer of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. And this is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Production designer Barbara Ling takes us behind the scenes of the latest Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Learn how she recreated a 1960s era Hollywood, her experience working with Quentin Tarantino, the challenges of shutting down Hollywood Boulevard, and so much more. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Well, we have a show for you. I am so excited to share this interview with Barbara Ling, production designer of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The work that she did on this film is absolutely amazing. It's a really great film, and I'm sure most of you guys have seen it. And even if you haven't, there's no spoilers here, so don't worry. But we do dive a lot into the sets, how they were created, how they were shot, the challenges of, you know, shutting down major streets in Hollywood. And what you'll be surprised by is that there is little to none CGI in this. Quentin apparently did not want any CGI. So everything that you saw in that film was real. And Barbara gives us an inside look into how they got that done. And that's all coming up in just a couple of minutes. But before we get there, I want to talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent your production equipment. But they've got some news because all throughout August, they're having a special event. And it's called, let me pull it up here. It is called Stay Steady in August. That's the name of the program. And why is it called that? Well, because they are offering 25% off the key gimbal stabilizers that you want. We're talking Free Fly Movie Pros, the DJI Ronin 2s, Zhiyun Tech Crane 3, Zhiyun Tech Crane 2, and the Manfrotto Fig Rig, which I actually haven't heard of, but that's kind of that circular frame with the crossbar, and it looks really, really cool and great for traveling shots. So much stuff there. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes, but you can also get there by going to rule.com, R-U-L-E.com, and checking it out. This is a great program running all throughout August 2019. You get 25% off those key gimbal stabilizers that you all want to get, that's for sure. So it's all there at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. All right, let's dive right in because there's so much to get to with production designer Barbara Ling. So I'm here with Barbara Ling, production designer for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Barbara, thank you so much for being on Go Creative Show.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on Go Creative.
How can we not? It's a Quentin Tarantino film. I mean, this is highly anticipated. And I love talking to production designers because I truly feel like they are the unsung heroes. And not on this show because we have a lot of them on and we're always celebrating them, but I think a lot of times what you see on the screen that you think is the job of the cinematographer, it's really the job of the production designer.
Working together, of course.
Giving
our credit. That's true.
And especially in a film like this, because there must have been so many challenges recreating Los Angeles in the 60s and with all the sets. And there's just so much to talk about. And I'm thrilled to have you on. So thank you once again.
Good, thank you.
Let's talk about how you got involved in the film. How did it all begin?
Well, I, with luck, met Quentin back on when he was doing The Hateful Eight, and just had a great conversation with him. And sure enough, you know, a couple years later, he called me and said, "I've got this film I want you to read. See if you would be interested in doing it."
What was your reaction to the script when you got it?
It was, well, first of all, you had to only go to, there was only one script. So you went to Quentin's house into his office.
No way.
Yes, everybody, all actors, everybody. And you read it there and then left it there. There was nobody took home a script. So, no, he was very top secret for good reason. Obviously, he'd had, you know, a script published once before they made the movie. So, yeah. They were very, very protective of that. And it was it's a phenomenal read. You know, it reads like a novel. He writes like no one else. He doesn't just write a screenplay. He writes a novel. He stops and explains who that person is and, you know, what they're doing and sometimes even what they're wearing. And, you know, he is so descriptive that it's, you know, it's mesmerizing. You're reading this. It takes hours to read it because there's so much to read, not just dialogue. And you know, you walk out just, I think it's probably the best thing I'd ever read.
Really?
I don't even know how you'd ever speak about it. You know, it took me days thinking about it to even then come back and actually have a meeting with him to talk about it, because it's so much in your head. You know, similar, I think, to the experience of actually watching the film for the first time. You know, if you go back to that film a second time, you go, wow, I didn't even notice that. You know, there's so much that you're looking at and hearing and seeing that you are never bored going back. I've seen this film now 4 or 5 times, and it's still amazing to me.
I'm mesmerized by this experience of you reading in his house. Like, is that unusual? I've never heard of that before, but was that unusual to you too?
It's attached. So it's, you know, you're reading in an office that's attached to his home. But yes, I think for the first, you know, for the, I'm sure for actors, it's something more normal. But it certainly wasn't normal to me, but it was, I understood it. You know, they weren't going to let the script out. They wanted one copy only, and everyone was scheduled to read that one copy. So, you know, and when we, you know, the last, quarter of the movie was locked in a, there was only one draft ever written of that.
Wow.
And it was locked in a vault. And most of the crew didn't have a script. And almost all the crew had no relationship to the last 50 pages. So, no, very tightly held script.
Now, you're saying this is one of the most descriptive scripts you've read as well. How does that help you? Or is it a hindrance? Like, is there something about being too descriptive from a production design standpoint? Or was it helpful to see really what his vision was?
Oh, no, it's incredibly helpful because you see, you know, what is alluring to him. You see what's alluring to the character that he's written, you know. You know, how this guy walks through an area or what area he walks through and what kind of car he's, you know, attracted to. It gives you an incredible sense of character, which is what the design, you know, is about. You're in the world that you're in, and you have these characters that you are creating worlds for them, their homes, their offices, their trailers, whatever it may be. So you're getting right up front kind of where Quentin's coming from on who this character's going to be. It's not one that, you know, it's not one having to have a conversation about, well, who was Cliff? You know, who was Rick? Who, you know, you have an incredible sense already by the time you have read that script. And then you start to fill in with all the things, you know, that you can bring back to the party, so to speak, particularly of L.A. at that time period and what areas. But no, Quentin, you know, he's a novelist who writes screenplays.
Yeah. All right. So you're reading the script and right away you're saying, okay, I need to recreate Hollywood in the 1960s. I'd love to know about how you begin that process, because I'm only thinking, I mean, just the challenge alone of just getting a street that's available to you to shoot in LA, let alone having to completely recreate the entire environment. Talk to me a little bit about how you began to prep for recreating Hollywood in the 1960s.
Well, the first thing you do is, of course, it's working with Quentin, and I come back with visuals of areas of LA, of areas of LA that, you know, of all the different areas, because, you know, LA is so spread out. You have, you know, choices to be in the West Side, to be, you know, within the valleys, or to be in the East Side, or to... And once we found the points that Quentin really wanted, absolutely Hollywood Boulevard, Westwood, we knew was a very, you know, intringent area. Other parts of Hollywood, the streets of Hollywood, pieces of, you know, Benedict Canyon, you know, certain areas, the Wilshire Corridor. Then it goes in to, and it's working with the locations heavily.
Yeah.
Of course, Rick Schuler was our location manager on this and was fabulous and had an incredible team. And, you know, it's going in, you know, the fun of Quentin is that he wants to be part of it very early. So, you know, you're getting in vans and we're going over to Westwood and getting out of the van and walking it so that he can feel, you know, the walk he wants the actress to make, or the walk, you know, what elements mean something to him. And then once, you know, you have a sense, these two blocks, this, both the theaters, the corner, then it goes to Rick's side, where he has to start getting the permissions first from the city of Westwood and from, you know, each, the owner of each building. And in the meantime, I'm back at the art department working with a fabulous researcher, Lance Melbourne, who, you know, we're getting all as much research of what was there and to make sure that we're in the right, you know, the Hamburger Hamlet was where the Taco Bell is. The Stan's Donuts was always there, but it was had a different facade. And then we come back and mush together with locations and say, I want to do this. I want to put this back up here. The theaters have to have, you know, the theaters are all LED marquees now. Nobody has the old backlit plexi with the big letters that, you know, glow in the dark. So it was, we had to rebuild and put facade, you know, reconstruct the marquees of that era. So that's, then it becomes locations in nonstop negotiations. And yes, you can do this, but we can't do that. So could we do this instead of that? You know, it's a breakdown of a lot of things at the same time as you're quickly designing, and you're knowing that you're going to have to pre-build everything and then put it up on the building. And then you have your third and, you know, the icing on the cake layer, which is Nancy Haig, my decorator, set decorator, and her team, who then, if we put a facade of stores back up, she then dresses the stores to be what that was. So it's a layering and, you know, interdepartmental, endless, nonstop meetings to try to kind of get all of this going and to get the delicate permissions to do what we had to do without impeding or closing down people too early, because that's, of course, a big thing. If you're Hollywood Boulevard's a classic case of that, is that, you know, this is a heavily touristed area, very heavily touristed. Every single day, 7 days a week, you know, every day of the year, there is huge tourism on Hollywood Boulevard. And when they went to get the permissions to close that down, and Quentin was generous enough to go with Rick Schuler and locations to address the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce and the city councils and plead the case of, you know, I love Hollywood and I want to put this back. This is the foundation of me being, you know, he did a very impassioned speech of, you know, where the roots of his filmmaking came from. And they gave us permission, which was very unique because it was a big impact. We could not do all of Hollywood Boulevard at the same time. we had to cut it into two sections and give some a couple of months in between, because already we created the biggest traffic jam in history, but it would have been beyond a traffic jam if we tried to take more blocks. You know, we took four at each time, or it would have just been, it would have been unbearable traffic-wise for the city of Hollywood. But we got the two sections, and that was a huge construction. And again, working with Rich Schuler and his people, going to all those owners, getting all the people to say yes to this, making all those deals, and then working out piece by piece, you know, starting with construction first, paint after that, and again, the last icing on the cake. Nancy and her group dressing these stores. And then the other flow, which is the amazing vehicles we had, all under Steve Butcher and his gang. The unbelievable costumes and the costume department doing just a unbelievable job with, you know, 1,000 extras. So you had this, you had layers of people, you know, until you built up to the week that you're shooting.
Oh my gosh.
When everything's there and all the marquees are on and all the neon's on and the people are walking and the cars are driving, you just go, wow, 1969.
That moment of just kind of seeing everything come together must just be, it's such a great feeling to walk on your set and be completely transported back in time. I mean, that's gotta be amazing.
No, it's why you're in this job, is for that moment, for that incredible moment when everything's lit, you know, right before action's said, and you are just back in time.
Completely.
Yeah.
I can imagine that so many people want that Hollywood Boulevard in their movies and just can't get it. I mean, that seems like it would be incredibly difficult to get. Is that the case, or do you find
it takes enormous amount of the negotiations are just endless because it's so many people. You know, the board isn't going to say anything to you until they see that you have signatures from all of these owners. And
yeah.
You know, every building has an owner, and then there's the guy who owns the store, and then the guys who have the apartments above the store, and the labyrinth of work that Rick Schuler, our location manager's department, had to do was unbelievable. And then once you've got enough people, then you go to the city and say, please, can we for this night close Hollywood Boulevard for these times? And I think the great thing was that Quentin is, you know, an incredible speaker, and he's an incredibly passionate human being.
Yeah,
and it's why even the crew that he has is incredibly passionate about him. Most of them have been with him for years because he's just electric in his passion of, and this to him was his opus to growing up in Los Angeles and all the things that made him a filmmaker. And so you needed him to be able to be there in front saying, you know, this is what everyone thinks Hollywood, you know, I want to bring that Hollywood back. So, And, you know, we were careful. It was like a military machine, how we had to do this. And each department. And as far as I know, we had no complaints, that people were actually thrilled, store owners, to be part of it. And, you know, it's everything got back. And, you know, people wished we could have left what we had. But
yes, they must have loved it.
Permanent. Yes. So, but we did give people fun for a little piece of you know, being able to be in nostalgia for a week. So,
yeah. Let's take a moment and talk about Hedge. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers, and it's super easy to use. It allows you to make multiple backups on set easily because you can import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations all at the same time. So you really don't even have to think about it. But the most important thing about it is that it's professional software for professionals. Before I was using Hedge, I was just dragging files all over my Finder. And that is not the way to treat your media. In production, your media is gold. That's your currency. That's what it is. That's what you're doing. That's what you're working towards is media. And you have to treat it with the respect that it deserves and using professional software to manage and copy this stuff. It's just so important. So I suggest you go over to hedge.video/go-creative-show and just check it out for yourself. This is the software you need to be using for your projects. And you get a 20% off discount of the full license by typing in Go Creative Show in the coupon code. And that's a great opportunity right there for you. But they also have other licensing available too if you don't need the full version. But go over there, check it out. They're always updating their software too. In the most recent version, they added filtering and renaming, which we don't have enough time to get into, but you can learn about it over at hedge.video. But basically, it's offering you a lot more customization on the metadata and also the way that your files are backed up. It's just so much better than dragging files around your Finder. You shouldn't be doing that. We're all professionals here, let's be honest. And we need professional software for our media, and that's what Hedge is. So go to hedge.video/go-creative-show. And lastly, let's talk about Magnanimous Rentals. Magnanimous Rentals is a rental house in Chicago, but they ship all over the country. And the best part is their prices are unbeatable. Unbeatable. If you guys haven't checked it out yet, now's the time. It's one of the sites I go to every single day. Why? Because they have these things called flash discounts. So you go to magrents.com and check out their site. And a lot of times they have these flash discounts. You know it's a flash discount because it's in bright red and there's a huge thunderbolt and you know what it is. But the most important part is that the flash discount is steeply discounted items. I mean, sometimes up to 50% off. That is no joke. Right now, as I'm on their site, they've got a Red Scarlet W. They have a Leica Summicron kit, all on flash discounts, an iDirect on flash discount, and a couple other things here too. And the prices are unbeatable. I mean, they're mind-boggling what they're able to do. I've rented a couple things from them now, and it's crazy how they have a sky panel on there too. So that's what you got to do. Go to magrents.com every single day and check out what's available, and especially the flash discounts. Now, the best part is it's only a limited time. So, you have to take advantage of the flash discount while it's happening, but your shoot can be anytime, but you need to place your order during the time frame that the flash discount is around. And they have a countdown there, so you'll know how much longer you have to make the choice. But really, you need to make magrents.com a stop that you go to every single day because there's so much great stuff there. You guys are going to love it. Head over there to magrents.com and see what they have to offer. Magrents.com. I've got an audience question from Jim Shields on Facebook. Mm-hmm. He wants to know, he says, I'd love to hear about the sources for reference material, classic movies, news stories, paparazzi photos. What were you using as your inspiration during this research period, I'm assuming?
Well, we had a great, as I say, Lance Mabon. And what Lance did is we first started with all the archives that you can get into, the libraries, all the newspapers, LA Times, the old Herald, all the archives that he got into for them. Then we started in with footage, a lot of footage of Hollywood Boulevard, of Hollywood streets. Lance was also able to find an enormous amount of private photographers, tracing different people, because getting color photographs is the hardest thing. Color, particularly in newspapers or any of that, it was always black and white. But even in magazines, unless you could find it, it wasn't that Life magazine had 1,000 street pictures of Hollywood. But movies were pretty great. And footage, you can go on different just footage like Getty footage and find sections of Hollywood Boulevard, 1968, Hollywood Boulevard, you know. And then we went to films. You know, Quentin, of course, as you probably know, owns the Beverly Theater. And even though that his theater was under renovation, they just threw sofas into it because all the chairs were gone. And he would play for the crew, you know, once a week, a 60s movie. So we also watched 60s movies, which was, you know.
Wow.
Another, oh, yeah. Quentin loves immersing everybody. We location scouted to KHJ. Every time Quentin got in the van, he popped another KHJ tape in so that we listened to the time period with which our movie is shot. Those days and that week, you know, is all he had every KHJ all day long. So, you know, it was always immersing, but footage was very good for color. And some of these private photographers who had great shots that were in, you know, that were good stills and good negatives that we would work with. So Lance, I give a lot of credit to digging very deep into not just archives, but also personal. And what's good is that once you meet one guy, then there's another guy. Oh, you should talk to so-and-so. He used to shoot, you know, stuff on the boulevard. So it was a lot of research, but a really difficult researching in one respect. It is interesting how color is kind of not so, you know, you go back a certain amount of time and you realize color kind of only came in the late 60s
for print.
You know what I mean? So,
And I think it's weird because when you watch an old film, that's now your reference point from that time period, especially people that weren't alive. But even if you were alive, you sort of like your reference becomes memories of films in a way, like they sort of imprint. So it's strange. It's like the real 1960s versus the film version of 1960s. I'm sure there are differences. I wasn't alive then, so I don't know, but I'm sure there's differences that you can play off of. Did you find more of your inspiration from the films and the media and the pop culture of the time period, or actual like news clippings and things from real events in the time period?
Well, it's interesting because both, you know, the irony is when you saw a real event and you had a photographer just shooting all around it, be it a, you know, a funeral or whatever it was, you know, you got an enormous amount of just what regular people were doing in this sea of photographs, right? Yeah. When you're looking at a movie, you certainly know that there is a direction happening. Like, okay, we're going to drive down this street, and the extras are said, okay, extras, go, you know? So I know that if I'm looking at a movie, I'm not really seeing it, you know, I would say besides print, documentaries were very helpful. Because again, what you wanted to see was the stuff that was on the street. And sometimes in movies, you clean it up, you know what I mean? You make things look a little bit more, you get rid of the trash cans or the, and you know, you wanted to put back that the street, you know, Quentin wanted real, you know, he wanted to really feel this world. He wanted to be able to stand with his actors, feel the world, and then be able to say action rather than, okay, we'll pretend that's over there, which is why he wanted no CGI, no plates, no green screen.
There's nothing, not even extensions, nothing at all?
No, the only thing is we occasionally, he would allow us to wipe away something so they could take out a building. You know, if you were doing a vista and there was a brand new tower,
sure,
that would be, but no, this is a very non-CGI movie, because it just, you know, he wanted to really feel and smell this world, not, you know, not have it be something that could be painterly, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it is interesting, the difference of, you know, even with Hollywood Boulevard, just looking at what Hollywood Boulevard is, and that, you know, there's great documentaries too. and usually the documentaries are about something like, you know, there's a war protest, but then the documentary just shows people walking down the street or, and you would say, oh my God, I forgot all about those weird trash cans they used to have, or the newspaper things, or the newsstands, you know, which you forget that LA, similar to New York, had newsstands everywhere. You know, they were, that's how people went and bought their papers and magazines. Yeah. You know, they didn't go into a CVS because those didn't exist. You bought them, you know, at these fabulous newsstands that were built on sides of streets. So all of that is why with print and with documentary, you get a lot more flavor in a way than you do by just looking at a movie. But the good thing with movies is that you're always seeing LA, you know, especially this was a driving movie. I mean, LA is always about driving. So for Quentin, it was about the motion all the time. You're never just in one area in LA. You're always driving to another area. If you're in Benedict Canyon, you're driving over the hill to the valley, or you're driving over to Hollywood. You're always driving. It still is that way. We just don't drive very fast anymore because we have such bad traffic jams. But you could actually drive in 69, you know, and get somewhere pretty quickly, you know.
I don't live in the area. I've been there a bunch of times, but I mean, just that was something that I was thinking when I was watching it last night. I'm like, this day will never exist again, being able to just get through the city. We actually have an audience question related. Travis Weirs on Facebook is asking, curious about all the driving scenes. How did you shut down the freeways and fill them with period cars? We sort of talked about this a little bit, but my question sort of related to this was, and I think you may have answered it, I was assuming that at least some of the driving scenes were CGI, but now you're making it seem like there's nothing at all. So
every scene is real world, and they were not easy to do the freeways.
Yeah, tell us about how that worked.
You know, we found certain sections, like there was a section of the Hollywood Freeway when you get on and around Bronson that still had the buildings. You had a good, you know, so we could, okay, if we get on the north and we drive this far, we can get this section. I can put a couple of the signs back to what they were. And we can put, you know, a couple of period little billboards and so forth. So, and then it was, of course, Rick Shuler and his department having to deal with the city to say, okay, after rush hour, before noon, you have 2 hours, and the first thing that happens is you know, the cars are all ready, the period cars, and they're in a long line. I mean, you couldn't believe what it was like to do the freeways. And then they would go, okay, period cars, go. You know, then it was, you know, get Cliff or Rick, whoever was in the car, get them in the car, and okay, now go. And, you know, camera car moving, and we shot all of that. There was no CGI. We got closed freeways on the west side of town, out by the coming off the Marina Freeway, because that was a bigger impact, because I had to change the overhead freeway signs, which is no easy feat, back to the period signs at that time. And we had to put, because it was night shooting, we had to put period freeway lights on. So, and that was no easy feat. So we got those, but that section we got closed for, you know, I think 8 hours. So on a weekend, and, you know, ending a late weekend night. So, but all the freeway stuff was done in different coordinations. We got pieces of the freeways out on the way to the Spahn Ranch. We got a few pieces of those freeways that they got closed down also for very short periods of time. So you had to work fast, then get all the cars out and then go. So, but it was important for Quentin. He wanted very much, you know, freeways you could drive and actually get places quickly on. So besides the streets, he wanted freeways. And I think we did a good job with it. It was fast, though. It was guerrilla warfare.
You certainly did. I mean, just a couple of hours. I know you had 8 hours for that section.
That was a tight sequence. The Hollywood, because that's literally the Hollywood freeway right in the middle of Hollywood.
Yeah.
So, and we created a horrible traffic jam.
If it was my decision, I'd probably be like, no, you can't have it. It's like, everyone's going to be pissed at me.
Many things they did say, no, you cannot have it. But they cajoled them on that one. And they said, we'll do it so fast. But no, there is no fast. It's you're still doing it. And you're still having an entire freeway on the other side going, hey, what are they shooting over there?
Exactly.
And so they fall down. So you, yeah. I doubt they'll probably allow that on the Hollywood freeway to happen again too soon.
I read that one of your most challenging, parts of the film was recreating the Taco Bell. Can you give us a little bit more information into kind of like how you did it and what was so challenging about it?
Well, again, Quentin so wanted, you know, the iconic early fast foods. And for him, it was Taco Bell. And the original Der Wiener Schnitzel, when it had the der on it, now it's just Wiener Schnitzel. They took the D-E-R off. I think I've seen stuff that looks like Taco Bell's, you know. So everywhere we're looking, the scouts are out. And, you know, interestingly enough, they've changed the buildings dramatically. So we were trying to find the... some of the original little adobe ones that we could put back. And way down in Tustin, we found one that was about to be demolished that had been, you know, two or three other restaurants, but it did have the original architecture. And since it was going to be demolished, they were going to let me put back, you know, kind of tear into it a little bit. So we rebuilt that one. And Taco Bell, of course, gave us permission to have the three-dimensional early signs built, and the little Taco Bell guy who, you know, was really original, who was always standing off to the side. So, and same with Der Wiener Schnitzel, we found around Long Beach, one of the old buildings, you know, those kind of great flat side buildings, but we wanted the originals had the drive-through right through the middle. And it was a tankeria or something now, but they had closed and we're going to reopen as something else. So they let me go back in and repaint. And again, we got permission to build a full scale that to put back on top of it, of the original Der Wiener Schnitzel sign and the drive through and all the, you know, menu boards, all that stuff, the light up menu boards. So we rebuilt to, you know, from the original little pieces of architecture back to their glory days. And, you know, both cases, people said, oh my God, thank God the Taco Bell's back. And we go, no, temporary.
You should have left everything. People would have loved
that.
We
know we're not doing it for under code, to last a lifetime. It's, you know, we're doing it under temporary engineering. So,
oh my God.
But yeah.
A question from Wes Anthony on Twitter. He wants to know, when you're, are you restoring a lot of vintage props, or are you going out and finding them and props that are actually picture ready?
Well, we find as many as we can. If you fall in love with the look of something and you can't find it, we build it. But, you know, thank God that, you know, if you're on a movie, you have time to go into the eBay world. And it's amazing how many props. Now, you may get that one prop, but if it's a hero prop, you're going to have to make two or three copies of it, because props notoriously can break. But, you know, that's, you know, both the prop master on this, Chris Call, was amazing and was pulling props, you know, just nonstop, finding things online. And then, yes, did indeed have to build a lot because if it was going to be smashed or broken or we had to create it, like the cans of dog food, which was Quentin's, you know, he had in his head, you know, kind of an idea for that, and that they'd be oversized and that they'd be a type of logo. So it's all those were built and created for the for the movie. But in set dressing and propage, if you can find something that still, you know, looks great, we may not have, you know, we found beautiful couch pieces and so forth. We had to recover them, but we still had the kind of a great mid-century piece that started with. And then some things we had to build because they were going to have to take a hit, or, you know, something was going to happen to it. And then when it comes to the Western world, you know, most of that you build because there's not much of that left anymore. And if it was, it'd be too old. It'd be 1800s and probably too old to use. So a lot of that is recreated on the Western sets.
Yeah, you basically had like three movies going on in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there probably more. I mean, the Bounty Law set, I can't remember the name of the movie, but the flamethrower movie, something fists, like 14 fists,
yes,
or whatever that was.
Uh-huh.
You had the Playboy Mansion, of course, all the stuff with the Manson family. Like, there's just so many sets and they're, yeah, all, yes, they're all placed in the 1960s, but they're representative of other time periods. So,
oh yeah, no, that's the fun, is that you're doing something, a Nazi set in a 69 movie, but it's, you know, like a Nazi era 1930s. And yeah. Yeah, with movies within movies.
I want to talk specifically about the Nazi set in Bounty Law, because you are representing, you know, the set for a Western film and then one for, you know, Nazi Germany film. But you're doing them when they're taking place in the 60s, trying to represent an older time period. So are you more authentic to the actual time period you're representing or the way that it was portrayed back in the 60s?
You try to be authentic a little bit to the time that it's, you know, you're in the Nazi set. It's, you know, a little bit of a piece of, you know, Hitler's, you know, Third Reich building. You,
yeah,
know what I mean? It's,
yeah,
iconic. But yes, it's also lit a little bit like a movie set. You,
yeah,
know what I mean? It's a, you know, it's the Nazi movie within a, but the look of it, yeah, you want to be as close to as if you were in that period. But it's, you know, it's a set, so, and you knew it was also going to burn, so it was a set that had to have many burn factors about it.
Yeah.
So, many tables, many chairs, many... And those were amazing stuntmen, I might add. So that was an amazing group who shot that sequence.
What was your most challenging set?
I would say that the biggest challenge, and most of it's because of the scale and the logistics, was Hollywood Boulevard, because of the enormous build of facades, the time period of how to do it, doing it with never closing the streets to tourism, you can't believe how many pieces, how many hundreds of pieces of neon and signage and all of that was changed over. So, and it was a very logistically difficult set. The one that was most challenging in scale for coming to go from absolutely zero to it would probably be Spahn Ranch, because it was just a dirt area. And from that, you had to create the world of Spahn, going back a little bit, starting with what it used to look like when it was a movie set, and then that dilapidation over the years and how parts of the movie set had become, you know, bikers' chop houses and George's house being, you know, the dilapidation still holding on to a structure. So you're designing in all these elements, looking back at history of what the old Western set would have looked like when George was young and there was actually movies being made there, to what it looks like now when it was, you know, the Manson family and pornos being made there. But that was a difficult set because of you were in the middle of kind of nowhere, Santa Susana Pass. It was an empty park service area, and having to kind of plot it out and figure out where corrals would go and where all this would go. So it was exciting when that all came together, so to speak. But it was a hard one, a very hot area. So it was a very long, warm period of time for all the carpenters and people working out there. You had short, short days because of course, one of our hottest summers, needless to say. They could barely keep standing.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called Lo-Fi Dreams by Trending Music. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Head over to premiumbeat.com and you get access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. And it's not just one track. No. You get cutdowns. You get loop sets. You get stems. Everything you need to customize the track to your project so it fits perfectly. But it's all about quality, let's face it. And that's what you're going to find at premiumbeat.com. So head over there, check out this song and all their others. premiumbeat.com. And lastly, before we get to the remainder of our interview, I want to talk about Shutterstock. Shutterstock.com, of course, you know them for stock footage and music and their great blog and photos and all sorts of stuff. But what you may not know is that they recently put out these things called Elements. And these are thousands of cinema-grade video effects for filmmakers. These are blockbuster-quality video effects, and they're created by industry professionals. So I'm talking about things like 4K lens flares, essential transitions, video kits like smoke, fire, explosions, and so much more. Like, this is a playground for people that want to play with video effects in their NLEs. Now, obviously, you know, professional graphics people are going to use this stuff and it's going to look amazing, but it's also accessible for people like me that don't really know that much about visual effects but want to dabble in it. So it's perfect for anybody. The stuff is not that expensive, especially for what you get. And there are thousands of them available at Shutterstock.com. So the way you get them is you go to Shutterstock.com, you hover over footage, and in the dropdown, it's going to be Elements. You'll find them right there, Shutterstock Elements. And check them out, because a lot of the videos, too, have like little, they're like samples of what the effects are and how they get, how you can work them into your project. So you get to see kind of the effects in action. And it's really inspiring stuff. And who knows, maybe one of you guys listening, you'll go to Shutterstock Elements, you try one out, and it may unlock this incredible talent for visual effects. You never know. So give it a shot. Shutterstock.com, hover over footage, and in the dropdown, you'll see Shutterstock Elements. You've got to check this stuff out for yourself. All right, let's get to the remainder of our interview. The finale, let's say, with production designer Barbara Ling. You know, I think your work is really, really beautiful. I mean, you have a string of just some of the most iconic films in the 90s as well, all the way up until today, of course, but you've got, you know, Fried Green Tomatoes, Falling Down, The Doors, another LA recreation, yeah. Right there, Batman and Robin. I mean, it goes on and on. Your work is really, really excellent. Something that I noticed in this film that I think you're particularly expert at is being able to create people's homes and really be able to tell the audience who this person is. Like, when you go into Cliff's home, you understand him better from his home than you do from any of his dialogue or anything that he does for the whole movie. The house that he lives in tells it all. I think Rick Dalton's home, same thing, in the juxtaposition between the two. I think, yeah. You know, you do a great job of filling people's homes with items that explain their personalities. And I'd love to just get a little bit of insight into how you're doing that.
Well, an enormous amount of it is of course talking with Quentin, because Quentin really knows these characters. He's lived with them. So, and he knows them so well that he, you know, we will come to the set as Nancy Haig, my brilliant set decorator, and I are there, and he'll have a little box with him of some pieces that he feels from his house that were always a Rick thing. So, you know, Rick's bar has pieces of Quentin. You know, he loves that part of filmmaking that he can put a little thing himself into, just a cup, just a mug, just a whatever it is that it, that speaks to him about his the characters he's created, which I just love about him, that he loves that. I've never seen a director be so, I mean, of course, you have to see Quentin's enormous collection in the world. He has a collection that's, you know, museum-like, and I'm sure he will have a museum someday.
Yeah.
He has a magnificent poster collection. So even in Rick's, you know, we had a saddle, and Quentin said, I know, but I want to use a saddle I have because I think it's more, so you know, he'd bring his saddle.
Wow.
But his posters, you know, we created, of course, Rick's, Dalton's posters, but, you know, he had a fantastic Hopalong Cassidy poster. And, you know, Quentin just said, yeah, I just think that'd be perfect. You know, let's put that one, you know, he's very part of his characterization on everybody. So he loved in Rick's, you know, we did this, created this bar, this that was just that kind of bachelor Spanish, you know, style bar. But Quentin had certainly ideas of some of the barware and pieces, and a couple of the posters. And, you know, almost all the posters we made in the movie come out of it's Quentin's head. He loves Italian, and he's in one of the great collectors of Italian movie posters, and the Italian illustrators who did those posters, but particularly through the 50s and 60s, the Westerns. So when we were doing Rick's, in Rick's character, which of course he's written him into this, doing spaghetti Westerns, you know, he would say, here's the movies, and Quentin would kind of, here's the movie title, here's the people who did it. And then we would, he'd say, I need to have illustrators for it. We even on two of the posters found one of the last of the great living Italian illustrators who's in his 80s. And we reached him via email and asked if he would be interested in doing an illustration for one of Quentin's posters. And Quentin is well known in that whole world as being an avid fan of their work and of, you know, Italian Westerns and all of the great directors that they worked with. And he said yes. So we had two of the illustrations done for Leo's posters from him. And then a few other ones were done by other illustrators that that are here in one in Germany and a couple of them in America. So, but those were really close to Quentin's heart, is those posters, because it's something he knows quite well and he has an unbelievable collection of, which someday hopefully people can see because it's staggeringly beautiful.
Did you shoot in the actual Playboy Mansion?
We did. And that, again, took Quentin to get it. The new owner had it completely under construction. There's a lot of work they had to do. So it was, you know, under construction and empty and things happening. And it took a long time to get him even to say yes to meeting. And he said, well, I'll meet with Quentin. And once Quentin said, you know, I just can't not have that real drive up. It just, you know, we could make it somewhere else, but it would be, and we got it. And, you know, he was great. He let me put back, you know, kind of the front, you know, the greenery and the lighting, the theatrical lighting that was always done for the parties, and the backyard, the same thing. We put back a lot of greens and theatrical lighting around the pool and all that, and recreated kind of some of the party look on the lawn. We didn't shoot a lot inside, so we inside was never the area of the foyer and stuff. It was just basically big, fabulous pieces of English furniture. So we did justice to putting it back to what I think, particularly then in the early part of the mansion, it looked like.
So the movie is just an absolute blast to watch. I mean, you really, Quentin has a way of making you feel like you are in the movie. They are all consuming. They take over your mind for the 2-3 hours you're watching it. They stick with you afterwards. And I think this one in particular, like, really felt like I was there. The authenticity is incredible, and in large part to your hand. And it's really, really incredible work. In our last couple of minutes, I'd love to just get a little bit insight from you as to how can someone sort of break into this production design industry? You know, for listeners that are kind of into this, that maybe are just starting out in their career, where can they go for inspiration? Should they mentor? Are there, schools that you recommend? Just what's a way to get into this production design field?
Well, I think the greatest thing you can do, particularly if you're starting out in this world, is to get onto a movie set. Be it, even if it's as a PA, whatever, I can't tell you how many art department PAs years ago I had who are now art directors. The one good thing about being on movie sets and being able to be, and like I said, being a PA, you're seeing it all. You're part of everything, and you can try to be a PA in an art department or a PA and, costumes, whatever thing attracts you. But even PAs I had in art department ended up being so drawn to editing, because they would be delivering stuff to the editing room, and they just go, the more they, and all of a sudden they went into the editing world. It's a way to see what everybody does.
Yeah.
It's a great way to learn. And from that, you make your avenues in, whether you're even in an art department, you may end up wanting to be a decorator or a prop master or the graphics or if there's one thing I can say is that really to get on sets is a great thing. Mm. And there's always work to be needed. So, And I mean, even TV sets, whatever you can get on, it's a way to learn by doing it. And then you can grow from that further if you want, But it's a, there's a hundreds of PAs on every film. So it's a world that's accessible, to tell you the truth.
Perfect. Now, you've had plenty of time to think. Are you prepared to answer our question about the piece of equipment or the item that you take with you on every shoot?
I would say the two things that I always have with me, because I start in location scouting first, is I would say a camera, mm-hmm. Or my phone is actually as good as any of the cameras I used to have.
Yes, times have changed.
A tape measure I always have, and a small notebook. But the notes are important, and as much as the phone is handy, there's just not enough time to write in the phone. So notebooks are important. And some things is that if you may fall in love with something and you find out that you're not going to get a camera down a hallway, or there's a certain amount of dimensions that have to exist for certain things to happen. So one thing I learned was always to either make sure that if I'm scouting, I'm with the location manager who has a tape measure, or I do, to say, "Ooh, we'll never get the camera in the house, so forget it." there's things that are just, you don't want to fall in love with something and then have the cinematographer go, "Yeah, shame we can't dolly." So, but I think, camera is the most important of anything, because it's really for your own purpose. It's recording what you are attracted to in that environment rather than just location pictures. It helps me later to go, yeah, the window, that was the great part of that house. So
it's always simple stuff. We've been asking this question more and more, and it always comes down to the most basic things, but it's so true that those are the things you need. The essential tools are oftentimes the things you have with you and are inexpensive. It's incredible.
Yes. And that's the thing that is the easiest thing, because sometimes you're scouting, you're walking for, you know, hours. You're not going to be carrying a computer or anything else with you. You're going to have a camera.
There you go.
And, you know, take an image of what is interesting in that, two or three images, you know. Anyway, but yeah, camera.
I love it. Barbara Ling, production designer for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and so much more. We'll put a link to your IMDb on our website at GoCreativeShow.com. Barbara, thank you so much. The work is amazing, and we'd love to have you back for your next project.
Great. Thank you so much for liking the movie.
How cool was that? Barbara Ling, thank you so much for being on Go Creative Show and sharing your experience on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Great film. And if you guys haven't seen it, go see it, especially now that you hear the behind the scenes. It'll put it all into perspective. Of course, I want to thank our listeners for asking their questions. We're doing that a lot now, so follow us on social media and you get an opportunity to ask your question on the show. On Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, search for Go Creative Show, and there we are. I also want to thank two people that make this show possible. Matt Russell, who mixes and masters and makes the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com. And our producer, Connor Crosby, over at ignitionvisuals.com. Without those two people, the show wouldn't exist. And you know who else I can say that about? Our sponsors. Of course I can. Our sponsors are amazing. Hedge.video, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, and Premium Beat. Support those that support us, and we'll keep cranking these out week after week. See you next time.